If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like Arena Football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Hey, happy Saturday. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis. Alongside Dave Zarum, Jeff Simmons. Lots to get to on the day before Super Bowl 49. Raptors didn't make it easy on themselves yesterday, but eventually come away with the win in overtime in Brooklyn against their old nemesis, the Nets. Leafs, they stink, but they might be doing it right for the first time in a long time. Maybe we'll even get to Tiger Woods and his 82 yesterday. 44 on the back nine, his first nine of yesterday, which, I mean, like, that's like an achievable goal for me to shoot 44 on a nine at that golf course. All that and more coming up in the next 2 hours. But I mentioned it. We are now in countdown mode to Super Bowl 49, which apparently is not Super Bowl IL, which would have made sense to me, right? L being 50 in Roman numerals. But apparently it's not Super Bowl IL. It's whatever it is, with a bunch of X's and I's and V's. New England Patriots, Seattle Seahawks. We'll save our predictions for the end of the show, gents. But I think the storyline going into this thing, obviously, it's been hanging over everybody's head. And you know what? Maybe mercifully it's been a storyline, because usually it's people just trying to force something down your throats for these 2 weeks before the Super Bowl. Deflategate. And we heard not a whole lot from Roger Goodell yesterday. The investigation is ongoing, and not shocking that the investigation is still ongoing. I mean, if you would come down with an adjudication before tomorrow's game and it involves some sort of punishment for Bill Belichick that happens next regular season, you'd have clamoring, well, why was he allowed to coach the game? So it makes sense, total sense, that nothing's going to happen until this game is over tomorrow. That being said, it adds this whole layer to this to breaking down this game and a filter to watching it, especially when you talk about whatever the result is for the New England Patriots. Dave, if the New England Patriots are the Patriots in like almost a no-win situation, right? If they win, they'll say, "Well, you only got here because you deflated the footballs." If they lose, well, you can't deflate the footballs anymore.
No, I mean, you know, first of all, they're in a win situation because they can win the Super Bowl tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
But secondly, you know, I don't see how, you know, the whole Deflategate thing impacts anything as far as the New England Patriots. You know, they have a history of kind of manipulating rules, if you want to put it that way, doing anything it takes to win. That's just how this team operates. So there should be no surprises there. They're trying to do anything to, you know, to put the game in their advantage. And the other thing is, you know, if that Colts game wasn't such a blowout, then we wouldn't be talking. I don't think this would be an issue at all. Because of the way they won, you know, it's clear that the ball's a little more inflated. That's a 35-point swing. I mean, it's just, to me, just a complete non-story. I don't know. Maybe I'm alone on this.
I think if the game was closer, it might have been a bigger deal.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. If the game was close, then we'd have something to talk about. But it wasn't. It had nothing to do with the footballs, the fact that they won in such convincing fashion. So I don't get why we don't drop it now.
Yeah. Are we in Deflategate burnout? Are you done with Deflategate? Have you had enough? Do you want to see video of this ball boy go into the bathroom for 90 seconds? Is that what you're interested in, Jeff? You're weird. Why do you want to see that?
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with football. Or Deflategate.
Yeah, that's just a whole other story.
Yeah.
I was in the States last week. I was in Florida. And anytime you would turn on the TV, that's all they were talking about.
Yeah.
Nothing about the Super Bowl, nothing about the NBA, nothing about anything else. The Deflategate, 8 hours a day, 100 different analysts talking about it.
I think you'd get some Americans to come up here and say, what? They just spent an hour and a half on the NHL, you know, like in July. They're breaking out NHL free agents, so I think it works both ways.
But what surprises me about that, and yeah, you know, you go to the States, turn on ESPN, turn on any sports network, and that's probably all they are talking about, like you said. But what I don't get about that is, like, there are so many things you can be talking about with this game. There's so many storylines to follow. This is a really compelling matchup, and yet this one thing is really taking over everything. Well, that and the Marshawn Lynch stuff.
Yes. Maybe we'll get to the actual game a little bit later on, because, yes, you're right. We haven't really talked about, nobody's talked about the game this week. And it is a compelling matchup. And, man, like I would be shocked if it's not a close game. These two good teams, these two good head coaches, and would make up for last year's Super Bowl, which was over in like 5 minutes. So that would be good. We could have a close Super Bowl.
It would be nice. I mean, but you wonder how much, you know, because the Super Bowl attracts so much media, non-sports media.
Yeah.
You almost wonder how much of it is because this is such an easy thing for them to grasp on. You know, if you're not really following the league during the season, or you don't know, like, the intricacies of the matchups and whatnot, this is a really easy thing that anyone can step in and you know, throw out their take on. So maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, it's either that or you have an opinion on Marshawn Lynch, who is doing his thing. You know, he's come up with a new phrase every single day. And if his purpose was to detract people from showing up and asking him questions, and his purpose was to get people to leave him alone, what he's done is done the complete opposite of his intended goal. Because it's just, I mean, it's turned him into the story. I understand that asking questions is probably stupid for the people at media day or at his daily media conferences. But you have to show up there. Like, if you're a member of the media, it's like that is one of the big stories of this week. What is Marshawn Lynch going to say? What's the go-to phrase of the day? And, you know, we thought this guy maybe has nothing to say. We'll get to some of his clips from his piece with Conan O'Brien in just a second. But I don't know. If his idea was to just get everybody to push all these media members away, and maybe he does have some sort of psychosis about being in front of a microphone, in front of a camera. Somebody should tell him that this isn't exactly the way to go about doing that, Jeff.
Yeah, it's a strange situation because all these people are up in arms that he's not talking. But at the same time, he's giving the media something to talk about.
Right.
He just goes up there and gives cliches after cliches.
Sure, how difficult
like Russell
is that?
Wilson does. Frankly, he's a boring interview. Then he's a non-story. But now they're complaining he doesn't talk, and now you got something to talk about on the radio, stuff to talk about on TV. At the same time, I think Marshawn kind of knows what he's doing here. I think this has almost built his character a little bit, and he's gotten some endorsement deals out of this.
Yeah, well, how many Beast Mode hats has he sold? By the way, we should mention that Jeff is wearing his Marshawn Lynch Cal jersey today, which is a nice jersey.
It looks pretty sharp, yeah.
Yeah, it's solid.
I like it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should get to Marshawn Lynch on Conan, actually, because what I'm going to say next about him kind of has to do with the revealing of his character a little bit. All right, so let's set this up a little bit. Conan O'Brien had Rob Gronkowski, Marshawn Lynch at a hotel in Arizona, and they played this new Mortal Kombat game. I don't know, was it for PS4 or whatever? It's like the most gruesome game maybe on the history of the planet.
It was unbelievable. I mean, I remember playing Mortal Kombat on the Sega Genesis.
Yes.
And it was nothing like that.
No. I mean, you would, I guess there was like Scorpion could like shoot that, the rope with with an arrow on the end.
Sub-Zero freezes people.
Yeah.
Lord Raiden.
Yeah, I didn't recognize any of the characters.
Yeah,
I think
don't know.
Raiden was in there.
Okay, good. He should have been.
Yeah, so this is, our knowledge of Mortal Kombat goes way back. But, so they were in this hotel, and they played a little video games, and Marshawn Lynch actually opened up. Here's how it sounded.
Finish him! Oh!
Oh! See, look, man, I'm gone. I ain't gonna tell all that. That's nasty, man. Come on, Hennessy, yeah. Y'all tripping, man.
How did that feel? That was too much for you. You couldn't handle it.
Yeah, nah.
It filled me with, like, a sexual thrill.
If that gave you a sexual thrill, you are a sick person.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, it's it looks like maybe the most gruesome video game ever created. Although I don't play a lot of fighting video games. Maybe they're all like that right now. But actually, pretty hilarious. 11 minutes, the entire segment. You can check it out. I tweeted it out yesterday. It's everywhere. Probably just have to Google Conan Marshawn Lynch. But I think Marshawn Lynch screwed himself because now people are going to continue to go back to him for quotes, for conversation, because they know that there is something there. There's something within Marshawn Lynch that's actually pretty damn funny, Dave.
Yeah, he proved that. First of all, like, I was really impressed by his comedic timing, you know? I mean, sitting beside Conan, who's I think a really funny dude, you know, he was holding his own with this kind of top comedian, or at least in that talk show format of the day. So yeah, he showed he has personality. He shows He can be funny. He showed he can be interesting. But that's the interesting thing with Marshawn Lynch, and that's what kind of made the whole I'm just here so I don't get fined one line answers. That's what made it so interesting is that Marshawn Lynch is a pretty compelling interview if you can get him to open up. You know, there's you know, just Google it. I mean, there's so many really interesting statements that come out of his mouth. So to see him be quiet now, maybe that's part of why it kind of irked everybody, because we know what he's capable of.
Why? I try to figure out why he goes about doing it. Now, on the one hand, if he, like, seriously has some sort of psychosis or some sort of mental problem about speaking to some of the masses speaking to the media, that's a problem.
If he's not comfortable with talking to the media, then the media should stop asking him questions.
And but I don't think that's the case, right?
I think maybe part of it is that, you know, he doesn't want to be bothered with it. You know, a lot of guys, you know, he showed on Conan that he's pretty open, you know, maybe no filter. So maybe a lot of these guys are concerned, like, it's safer just not to say anything at all.
We'll go back to his time in Buffalo, right? He got hammered a couple of times from, you know, some of his comments in the media. Couple of them ripping the city of Buffalo, which is, you know, understandable.
And look at, like, Russell Westbrook last week, too. I mean, some of these guys, you get the feeling, like, if they get burned once or twice by the media, they say, you know what, this doesn't need to be a part of my brand. This isn't helping me. You know, it's hurting me. I'm just not going to participate. And, you know, it sucks for the media people trying to do their jobs, but, you know, I understand it.
Yeah, I followed his career pretty closely, and I think you guys nailed it with Buffalo. He had a rough kind of go there. And Marshawn grew up in he grew up in the inner cities of Oakland, and he has a hard time trusting people. And kind of after what happened with Oakland, is he kind of lost the trust in the media, and they're really hard on him. He said he was racially profiled a lot in Buffalo, and since then, this has been a consistent thing. And I know some people in the Seattle media, they're fine with it. They say that his teammates love him. He's a great teammate, and that you saw in Conan what his teammates say about him. That's the kind of character and the kind of personality he has, and his best friend on the team the last couple of years has been Michael Robinson, the fullback. He works for the NFL Network now. I don't know if you guys have seen. He had a show where he'd go around the locker room. It was called The Real Rob Report, and he'd interview everyone. And Marshawn, who's his best friend, refused to speak on the show.
Really?
Yeah. They have a segment messing with Marshawn, and Marshawn would just hide.
Yeah, so members that he doesn't know.
No. There's a couple guys he'll talk to, and this comes back to trust. There's a writer from NFL.com who he knows from Cal, and he's a really compelling character, and some people I see in the media call him stupid and immature. That's not the case. He knows what he's doing here. He's a really smart, he's a deep thinker, and he's got a big community following in Oakland. He does a ton for the community, and I think he's misconstrued completely.
But I think he's gained more support during this whole thing, you know, as far as the general public is concerned. You know, I don't really care what the other media thinks.
I think it's an age thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think the younger people can more relate with Marshawn. Mm-hmm. I find this on Twitter, and I think the older classic media guys
get off my lawn.
Yeah, they're more offended, and they have the sense of entitlement that Marshawn won't talk to me. Who is this guy?
It's also difficult for us to understand or us to gauge what the perception is working in the media, right? Because we have a different sensibility when it comes to these things, because we've, you know, I stuck microphones in people's faces and needed quotes for stories and whatever. Okay, we're gonna put this to bed in just a second, but we have another clip from Conan and Marshawn Lynch. So what the hell, let's play it.
Marshawn, what about you? What do you like to play?
Mario Kart.
What do you like about Mario Kart?
Toad. And I like driving.
You like driving?
Yeah.
And you like to drive as Toad?
Yeah.
And that's you driving?
Yeah.
You're pretty intense.
That's how Toad do.
Right.
I probably look more like Donkey Kong.
Yeah, but now I'm Bowser, and I just come right over and run over you.
You got to get a mushroom or a lightning bolt to make it little first.
I know. That's why I begin it. Yeah,
see, I get that shells. Little blimp. You know what I'm talking about? That coming right there, little
poor drunk.
And I be smashing through. Soof.
Yes. Marshawn Lynch enjoys himself some Mario Kart. Who doesn't? So good on him. It's entertaining. I watched the full 11 minutes. How often do you go online, see a video is 11 minutes long, and watch the whole thing? I did that with that, and I did not regret it. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarab. Super Bowl 49 coming your way tomorrow from Arizona. Patriots and Seahawks. Marshawn Lynch obviously going to play a key part in it. How much of the legacy stuff is involved here, guys? All right, already Russell Wilson, this will be his second Super Bowl appearance in 3 years in the league, which is ridiculous. And then you got the Patriots, on the other hand. We know the history there with no Super Bowl victory since Spygate. I don't know if that's a big deal. I mean, they've made Super Bowls, and, you know, they've had it within their grasp you know, a couple of times against the Giants and haven't won. But Tom Brady, the possibility of a fourth Super Bowl win, mm-hmm. joining an elite group of three quarterbacks to do it. Whose legacy changes the most with a victory tomorrow?
Well, you know, you bring up why I think this is such a compelling matchup is the fact that there's so much like history at stake. You know, the Seahawks doing it back-to-back with Pete Carroll and whatnot. That's really, really rare in today's NFL, obviously. I don't think it's happened for 10 years. And it might not happen for 10 years again, you know, down the line. Who knows? But also, you know, Brady and Belichick, these guys, you know, they're staking their claim as, you know, potentially the best ever. And you need Super Bowls to be able to make that claim. And it's like, you know, last week on Saturday Night Live, they had that joke, you know, Brady's won six Super Bowls if you include the three he's lost. So, I mean, he's making his claim as one of the all-time greats. He already is. But, you know, to have the four Super Bowl wins, I mean, that's pretty, you know, pretty unique.
Yeah, I'm not a huge legacy guy until the body of work is complete. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I think it's interesting, especially with New England. And Brady and Belichick have had that cloud. We mentioned the Spygate. They haven't won in 10 years.
Yeah, which doesn't seem right.
No, they're in it every year. Their sustained success is incredible in football. It's so hard. And they haven't won in 10 years, and there was the Spygate stuff, and they've lost the last two to the Giants. And I think beating a defending champion and a team as strong as the Seattle Seahawks, I think that would really establish their place in history.
Do you think, Simmons, you think that the Seahawks are in a position, you know, when you look at the makeup of their team, to maybe be a team like New England in terms of, you know, someone we see in the Super Bowl fairly regularly?
I don't know if you'll see the 10-year period they had because their division was so weak, but I think in terms of they could be the next team. They got the young quarterback.
Yeah.
They've signed a ton of these guys. It's not like they're going to be having, once Russell Wilson gets signed, they're not going to be losing the guys. The mm-hmm. salary cap's going up, and they've pretty much signed all their key guys. And I think another thing with the legacy, I think Pete Carroll is another compelling figure. And
yeah, he maybe doesn't get enough credit in this
Yeah,
run.
And
the oldest head coach in the NFL, which is like mind-blowing.
Pete Carroll?
Yes.
Really? Yeah.
People see him high-fiving around, and they remember the stuff at USC, and you don't see him as a typical coach. He's kind of got the reputation as a player's coach, and there was the sanctions at USC, and he left. I've read a lot on Pete Carroll, and I've talked to a lot of people about him. Something like Steve Kerr said he went down to Seattle's practice this year, and he said he's never seen anything like that before, and he's never seen that kind of controlled chaos. Dwayne Casey was down there. He's brought his staff down. And Pete Carroll's really changed that team. That team was almost irrelevant before he got there, and I've been following the team for over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
To see them back-to-back Super Bowls, and if he can go and beat the team that fired him and beat Brady and Belichick, where's that? That should really establish his legacy as one of the great coaches ever.
Yeah, it's a good point. What about this? Okay, so we were talking about Peyton Manning and the possibility of him riding off into the sunset after the disappointment of that loss to the Colts and him just not looking right in the last five or so weeks of the season. Tom Brady, we know he restructured his contract here. We know it was kind of a weird dynamic between Bill Belichick and him, those two dueling press conferences. What are the odds, Jeff, that Tom Brady wins a Super Bowl covered in confetti and he just rides off into the sunset with Giselle and just sits on her $40 million a year for the rest of his life?
I don't see it. He's still playing at such a high level. And earlier in the year, we all thought people started questioning whether he was done. He's been incredible since that point. And I just don't see it. He said he wants to play. He said he wants to play late into his 40. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I still think he's got some years in him. I don't see him grinding out right now.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Manning situation, you know, he's got the health issues with his neck and things like that that are obviously big factors. And yeah, Brady's contract might be a factor, but, you know, as long as he's still playing at a high level, you know, I don't see these guys are competitive. You know, it's hard to turn down more money, even if you have a lot of it. So I'm told. So, yeah.
Want more yachts?
Exactly.
I'll take
dueling yachts. Yeah, play a little bumper boats or something. All right. How do we feel about Katy Perry? Katy Perry fans? Where are you at for halftime shows? Because I loved Prince. I'm not even like a big Prince guy.
Prince blew
halftime
me away.
Was amazing.
Yeah, I had low expectations. And
he was able to show that he's a really good musician. You know, he's a killer guitar player. He never gets enough credit for that nowadays. And so he was able to show that off. I love the Prince one. You know, the Who one was really depressing because everyone loves the Who, and they were just, it was sad to watch. I don't even remember what happened last year.
Bruno Mars.
Oh, yeah. Bruno Mars is actually pretty good. I'll give it up for Bruno Mars. Pretty good entertainer.
You know, I don't know, Katy Perry. She's got hits. She's, you know, really popular. She's
She's
good
got
performer.
What? Oh, hits, yes.
Hits.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, and, you know, aesthetically pleasing, I think it's going to be a good show.
Yeah, no
question.
I'll
be watching.
Let's look at some of these props before we go any further. Speaking of Katy Perry, what do we make of this? What will Katy Perry be wearing when she begins the halftime show? Skirt or dress, 4 to 5. Pants below knees, 2 to 1. Shorts above knees, 2 to 1. Now, skirt or dress, I found that one hard to believe. I don't know if I've ever seen her in a skirt or a dress. I would think it's always like those booty shorts, right?
Yeah, I'm taking the shorts above knees.
Yeah, it's not going
to
be
I'm running to the bank.
Pants below knees?
That's not what you wear.
So you're going to wear like a pantsuit?
What is pants below knees? Isn't that just pants?
Yeah, I guess that's pants.
The three quarters, there's the...
The schpants, right?
Yeah,
schpants.
Those are kind of...
The Rafael Nadals.
What color will Katy Perry's hair be when she begins the halftime show? You got black, brown at 2 to 1, which I guess is her natural hair color. Pink, red, 3 to 1. Blue, green. I mean, that's... I can't believe it's only 3 to 1. That seems like free money. Mm-hmm. Blue, green, blonde, 4 to 1. Purple, 5 to 1. Seems like, I mean, that's a no-brainer, blue, green, right?
Couldn't she just bet on herself and go with the long one?
I think.
Is that a?
Yeah, I don't know how
that
works.
She wants to spend the rest of her life in prison.
Yeah, she wants to be, you know, she'll be with Pete Rose somewhere. Jeff, you can't do that. Are you crazy? Okay, how about this one? How many times will deflated balls be referred to?
Oh, my God.
During the game, this seems exceptionally low. 2.5 mentions during the broadcast.
Yeah, you take the over on that.
That's free money, right? Over 2.5? Seems like it.
I'm surprised the line's not set at like 7, 8.
So is that
nine?
Anytime they just say deflated balls or anytime they mention?
Yeah.
Deflate gate?
No, it says deflated balls in quotation marks.
Okay.
So I guess you have to actually say
that exact
deflated
wording.
Balls. Yeah. What are you guys doing for Super Bowl? I'm going to Mike Wilner's house.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. There's actually a few fan guys going over there, but you got any plans? Jeff, I feel for people that actually are a fan of either team because you don't necessarily want to be around people who don't give a crap about this, the actual outcome. Like, I don't care who wins, but you care. You want the Seahawks to win. So where are you watching this?
It's a little different. You nailed it right there. I got to be in a controlled environment. I don't want any people who are going to be annoying. I don't want any Patriots fans. I'm watching at my place with a couple friends.
Invite only?
Invite only, and it's very limited. You have to be a certain type of character to be invited.
Certain type of character.
When we leave here, I'm boarding a flight to Phoenix. You know, I'm going to be watching with my buddy Dion, probably from the 50-yard line, fifth row, I think.
I feel like that's not true. I feel like what you're saying is not accurate.
Serum's a big deal.
Yeah, well, you know, my buddy Dion and I, we go way back.
All right, well, I'll be at Wilner's. I got to fill out my prop sheet because Wilner's got illegal gambling going on. When we come back, Raptors with a big win in Brooklyn yesterday. They won 5 straight. They run their record to 9-0 within the Atlantic Division. That division stinks. But yesterday was a pretty good game, and a pretty good game tonight as well on Sportsnet. They are in Washington against the Wizards. Eastern Conference playoff positioning on the line in that one. We'll break down the Raps and look at their recent play, turning it around after that little slump earlier this month, late December. That's coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Azarum and Jeff Simmons. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Michael Grange.
The only sore spot I have in the whole thing, obviously, is that, you know, when I left, for the most part, to a man, everybody said the team was bereft of talent, all-stars, and future. And I completely disagreed with the notion, but I even had to question, you know, that notion myself.
That's Brian Colangelo, the longtime general manager of the Toronto Raptors, and that's about as close as he'll ever come to admitting a crisis of confidence. Which is what he had, ever so briefly, after the 2-time NBA Executive of the Year was pushed out of the ACC by Tim Lowicki. Just like that, the general manager with the Midas touch was out of the NBA for the first time in more than 20 years. It's been nearly a year and a half since he left the Raptors, and he still hasn't found his next NBA job. But his old club's resurgence under his successor and former protege, Masai Ujiri, has forced a re-examination of Colangelo's record. And you know what? It's not bad. It was Colangelo who drafted DeMar DeRozan and signed him to what is now a below-market deal. It was Colangelo that drafted Jonas Valanciunas and traded for Kyle Lowry and hired Dwayne Casey and acquired Amir Johnson for a pittance. He even recommended Ujiri for his old job. With a record like that, perhaps it's time Colangelo got a job of his own.
As I said before, it's so far past me at this point that it's irrelevant other than helping me potentially reestablish credibility that's required to stay alive in the business.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Jeff Simmons. The Raptors coming away with an overtime 127-122 win over the Nets yesterday, and they're lucky to have picked up that W. The Nets had a chance at the end of regulation. Wide open look for Brook Lopez. Maybe a little outside his range, but clanged off the iron. Ends up going to overtime, and Raptors outscore the Nets 14-9 in that final frame. They let another lead slip away in the second half of that game. And defense hasn't exactly been what it's been, I don't know, the last couple of weeks, last couple of games. It hasn't been up to that level. But the offense is back, Dave. I mean, this is what this team made its name early this season, that great start. It was on actually pretty lousy defense, but on like otherworldly offense. And it seems like last couple of games, they're getting back to that.
Yeah, definitely. And you can see, DeMar DeRozan getting more comfortable back in the fold. You know, he's been huge the last few games, as he was last night. And you know, but as far as the defense, you know, in that game last night against Brooklyn, I think they just ran into a Brooklyn team that was just kind of on all cylinders. They played way above their level if you look at how they've been playing over the last little while, the last month or so. I mean, that was an anomaly for them. You know, Brook Lopez, I think in the previous game, had 4 points or something like that. And then last night, 30-plus with the season high. Jared Jack, career high. I forget what he finished with. Like
35,
yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how much of that is a fault of the Raptors as opposed to, you know, the Brooklyn just kind of playing out of their skull. And credit to the Raptors, you know, I don't think they got lucky in winning that game. I think they kind of did what winning teams do and kind of found ways to get it together.
Well, they're
at the
lucky
end.
That Brook Lopez misses a wide shot, open jumper at the end of regulation, right?
All right, fine. The one shot that could have been a game winner.
Yeah.
Outside of that, though.
Yeah. And they are back to being an exciting team and an enjoyable watch, right? Because even when they were winning against the Sixers during that slump where they hadn't had a good game, you know, they lost in overtime in Portland to that Blazers team. And then they went on a stretch of about 2 weeks where it was just kind of misery to watch them play. Even the wins against the Celtics, against the Sixers, against the Pistons, those were meh.
And those were, it was worrisome because sure, they were winning games, but they were doing it, they looked a lot like their opponents while they were doing it. And they were playing some of the worst teams in the league, you know, playing down to their level. So when you see, you know, they're beating teams like Brooklyn, Detroit, Sacramento, which are also, you know, pretty bad teams. But the difference is that they looked, you know, considerably better than them for the most part, you know, save for last night.
Yeah. What happens when a star comes back from a lengthy injury is there's a big adjustment period.
Huge.
And this happened with DeRozan. When a guy like DeRozan's out, everyone, their role changes. And when a guy like DeRozan comes back, it's human nature to expect he'll be at the same level he was when he left. But that's not the case. There's an adjustment period for him, and there's an adjustment period for their roles. And Lou Williams mentioned that they, some of them had trouble going back to their old roles. And people are, they kind of had to rediscover who they are. And DeRozan had to get back in game shape. And this is a thing that's happened. It happens in sports all the time. You can't just come back and be the same guy. And there's a human element to it.
And especially, too, when it's a guy who you rely on so much for, you know, you run your offensive sets through him. You know, he's got the ball in his hands at the end of games. You know, he's a huge part of the team. It's not just like a rotation player getting out and trying to replace that. It's your go-to guy.
I hate to make a hockey analogy, but
You don't. You love it. You live for it.
Well, I started thinking about this when DeRozan, when Matt Sundin went out, and I think it was 2002 in the playoffs, Alan McCauley went to the first line, and the team played great. When Sundin came back, I think it was in the Carolina series, the team wasn't as good because McCauley had trouble going back to his old role, and Sundin couldn't produce the way McCauley was. And when I watched the Raptors, I'm like, this is the same thing. And now DeRozan's back, and they've had that stretch where they're comfortable. And
You know, part of the uncomfortability earlier on when he just came back too is because, you know, when you look at what Casey did with his lineup and putting Gravis Vasquez as a shooting guard, it moves DeRozan to small forward. And while, yeah, sure, he plays enough minutes there during games, you know, it is a bit of an adjustment when he's guarding the bigger guys, being guarded by bigger guys. So you wonder how much that was a factor too. But yeah, I think you're really impressed with how well he's looking now. He looks really comfortable. Obviously, last night he had a huge game. It was 29, 9 assists.
26, and he was 9 of 17 from the field and 8 of 9 from the line. I mean, that's been the big key, right?
And
getting back
huge,
to the line.
Especially in those close games, you know. And I think the Portland game was a perfect example of that that you brought up, where, you know, down the stretch you need to stop the clock. You need to kind of because those free throw situations, they're almost like timeouts in a way, right? It allows you guys to regroup, coach, and communicate with his players. And it also takes the other guys out of the game, you know, the opponents out of the game, get them in foul trouble. So he's, you know, outside of James Harden, he's one of the best guards at that. And it's good to see him back in the swing.
You can't talk about sports these days without talking about analytics, advanced stats. Okay, in basketball, there's some interesting ones. And I'm just kind of like getting into it and understanding all of them. I'm pretty well versed in the baseball ones, and we're learning every day about the hockey ones, and they're getting better at analyzing the game. The basketball analytics have been around longer than the hockey ones, not quite as long as the baseball ones, but there's a lot of teams that live and die by them. And I mean, I hate the analogy that the Houston Rockets are the biggest analytics team in the NBA. You know, it helps having Dwight Howard and James Harden on your basketball team. Okay. Yeah, I don't know if you necessarily need all the analytics in the world to...
I mean, Harden's the MVP so far, probably.
Yeah, I don't know, him or Steph Curry. Although Klay Thompson's been ridiculous the last couple of weeks, too. But DeMar DeRozan is kind of that guy that bucks the analytics, right?
Yep.
Analytics, when you boil it down to its essence, is take threes and dunks and layups. Do not take long twos. Try telling that to DeMar DeRozan. He's like a throwback, isn't he, Dave?
I mean, he's a throwback in the sense that the mid-range is a maybe the biggest element of his game, you know, outside of getting to the basket. And you know, old-school basketball, going back to the 60s, 50s, 70s, whatever, it's all mid-range shots. You know, that was kind of everyone's bread and butter for a lot of the great players. But, you know, with him, what I think gets lost in all the talk about analytics, you know, you can use these numbers to tell you what's good and what's bad. But, you know, It ignores the fact that this is DeMar's game. You know, for him, a long two or a mid-range shot might be similar to someone else's three, if that makes sense. I mean, you know, what I'm saying is
no, that doesn't make sense because a three is worth
no,
three.
No, but it's a good shot for DeRozan versus a three-pointer, which he hits at a lower rate.
Right. But
For the average NBA player to hit a long two is probably a bad thing. And sure, big picture is probably a bad thing for DeRozan too. But compared to other NBA players, he's a guy who you're more comfortable with taking those shots.
And I guess, I mean, it's hard to get away from habits that you've ingrained in yourself your entire career.
And I mean, working on the last profile I did of him in our magazine for our NBA preview, you know, I was there at the gym with him when he was working out like at night, like on his own, just shooting around and whatnot. And he's hitting these shots, you know, a couple steps inside the three-point line, and he's just hitting all of them, different turnarounds, whatnot. I mean, I know all these NBA guys seem to hit every shot when no one's guarding them in practice, but this is a shot he crafts. You know, he hones this. He knows when to use it in certain situations, you know, different ways to get his shot off from those deep mid-range shots. So it's part of his game.
My only counter to that would be, and you saw it actually in that fourth quarter of yesterday's game, although DeMar DeRozan kept them in it when they couldn't hit a shot, finished that quarter or started it 0-for-5, whereas a couple of times, and I tweeted about it and people were talking about it on Twitter, is that occasionally when this team needs a bucket, it doesn't look good when the result of your play is one of those long twos from DeRozan, from somebody else.
Well, if they were talking about it on Twitter, then you know it must be dead on.
That's right. That's where all the truth lies, is in Twitter.
But, you know, you think of that and one kind of floater mid-range shot he had.
Well, Lou Williams just, I mean, gets fouled. He's somehow able to get fouled every time he puts up a shot. I don't know how he does it, but he does.
So DeMar did his impression of Lou Williams, you know, yesterday with that one shot, and it was at a crucial time in the game. But that's a shot that he practices, is what I'm saying. It wasn't just like a fluke shot. It wasn't like a bad shot. It's like a layup for other guys for him taking that shot. It's a bit of an exaggeration. But
no, it's not a layup, though. It's a long two. Yeah. I think you're making an excuse for DeMar DeRozan. I think if DeMar DeRozan was being truthful, maybe if he wasn't being truthful, but if Dwayne Casey was being truthful about what he wishes DeMar DeRozan would do, would, you know, drive, get to the line.
Which he does.
Yeah. But in those situations, you see him maybe not use that, although he did a key bucket where he handed off to Amir Johnson.
Listen, you take what the defense gives you. You read the defense. You know, when they're giving you that shot and you know you can make it because you make it all night in practice and whatnot, you take it. When the defense is there, when they collapse on you, when you drive like they did on the last play, you find your open teammate like he did with Amir.
Yeah.
Right?
Speaking of Twitter, because this is how you view sports now, through the prism of Twitter. But I'm glad it's a place that you can go to kind of get on the psychiatrist couch occasionally, and voice your concerns and get in touch with a community that share the same feelings as you. And a lot of people are, I don't know if confused is the right word, angry, frustrated with the deployment of Jonas Valanciunas in late game situations. And Dave, I know it's a conversation we've had more than a couple of times on the radio. And Jeff, I'm sure you see it. You see the same thing in late game situations where Valanciunas can be having a great game, offensively, defensively, getting involved, active. And when it comes down to crunch time, he's lifted. And yesterday it was for Patrick Patterson, who has kind of turned into this guy that's able to rebound out of nowhere, where it was never really a part of his skill set. And I get it, and they won the game. But at some point, Dave, when you're talking about developing your big in Jonas Valanciunas, isn't he going to need to play in those late game situations?
Yeah, you know, you need reps. Obviously, that's a big part of development. So you need to be out there actually playing. And the thing with last night was, you know, he had, I think, 11 rebounds when he was sitting on the bench, team high rebounds when he was on the bench during the kind of dying minutes. And you saw so many times where Brook Lopez would kind of just reach over Patterson or Amir and snag offensive rebounds or second chance rebounds. And those are things that, you know, when Jonas was in the game, he was taking those out of Lopez's hands, you know. He was really assertive last night. And that's kind of, for me, that's the biggest, I don't want to say red flag, because I do like the look with Johnson and Patterson in there down low. But just the way, the kind of groove that Valanciunas was in last night, he was super confident against another 7-footer. You know, so you want to see that be rewarded more, I guess, is why it irks a lot of people.
And that's a huge front court.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, if there's any team you need that size against, you know, you'd think like the Plumlee Lopez starting front court. And Valanciunas was really effective against him, as he is against most big guys.
It wasn't a foul issue either. It had one foul.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, you know, Casey is really comfortable with that Johnson-Patterson look. You know, I like when Patterson's in there too, so it's hard. We were talking about that before. You know, like, who do you take out to put Valanciunas in? Amir was having not the game of his life, but he's having maybe his best game of the season.
Yep.
You know, crucial on both ends of the floor. And Patterson gives you a really interesting look at the four, and he's proven against Brooklyn also in that stadium that he comes up in the clutch. So who do you take out for Valanciunas?
It just seems like there's never a situation where Dwayne Casey has faith in Jonas Valanciunas in late game scenarios. Yeah. And it's, you know what, it's not just late game scenarios. Now, occasionally and recently maybe you can say that the offense is running through him a little bit more, but there's been many times during the Casey Valanciunas tenure that you said, you know, this part of the game is working so well, and it's such a luxury to have a big man who's able to score. Why wouldn't you keep going down there? And again, maybe it's not Dwayne Casey's fault, because I mean, he's not calling out a play every time down the floor, right? I mean, part of this is on
the
point guard.
I think a lot of that comes to the guards in terms of recognizing when your big is hot and when he's in a good position to get the ball. It comes down to your guards recognizing that, and that's something that, you know, I think Lowry and all the guys have done a much better job of. Especially over the last month, 2 months, maybe. You know, another thing with Jonas, though, is that, you know, you wonder if Casey has some, you know, if he questions maybe what Valanciunas brings defensively versus a guy like Patterson. I mean, yeah, he's going to probably rebound better. He might be a better rim protector, but, you know, he does still kind of, he's still learning how to guard space. And that's something that Patterson does really well in terms of, you know, running the baseline, spreading himself out, things like that, lateral quickness. So, you know, I think he might be more comfortable with Patterson on that end of the floor as well.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Jeff Simmons. Raptors in Washington tonight at 7
Huge
o'clock on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, also on Sportsnet. It's actually quite comical if you go to sportsnet.ca and look at the schedule for sporting events on the network today. I believe every sporting event that is taking place in North America and Europe, actually, is on Sportsnet on the Sportsnet 360 are the Raptors and Wizards. And we've talked, Jeff, all season about expectations and goal posts being changed for the Raptors. And when they were off to that ridiculous start, it was all about winning the Eastern Conference. I think you can almost hand the Atlanta Hawks the Eastern Conference crown at this point, as we're not even to the All-Star break. But finishing in the top three, I think, is a realistic and almost necessary goal for this Raptors team. So how important is tonight's game, Jeff?
I don't know.
Must win.
I don't know if tonight's a must win.
Must win.
But I think it's a good measuring stick. And in the East, there's five really good teams, and Cleveland is now into that conversation. They've won nine in a row. And Toronto and Washington, it's a fascinating matchup. Washington's got a good front court. They got a really good back court, and they're a pretty deep team. And you got Paul Pierce, who's been a notorious guy the Raptors have struggled with in their career. And I think it's a really good measuring stick for them, and the Raptors are really playing better, but a lot of it have come against weaker competition, and this is kind of the matchup for them that they could see in the second round if they really want to progress.
Ends that streak of five straight games against sub-500 teams.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, I really do think, you know, contrary to what you're saying, I think that it is maybe the biggest game of the season. It's a huge game because of the...
Must win. You're saying it. Must win. Fold the franchise if they don't win. Right, Dave?
Or, yeah, move it maybe. I don't know.
To Vancouver?
Yeah, I'm sure they'd love that. But, you know, when you talk about the standings, you know, this Washington team is the one that you're competing against, jockeying for position when you look for the rest of the season. What do the Raptors have to play for now? They're guaranteed in the playoffs. So right now it's about...
Guaranteed top four.
Yeah, guaranteed top four just because of, you know, how inept the Atlantic Division is. So you need to get those wins against the teams that are right around you in the standings in that 2-3 spot. I do agree that you don't want to be finishing in the fourth spot facing Chicago or Cleveland. That's not going to be a position.
Or Washington.
Or Washington. That's not going to be you're going to be really in tough advancing a round against those teams, and that's the goal this year, right? At least advance one round.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are sleeping on John Wall's season this year. He's having a great year. Bradley Beal was out earlier for the one matchup the Raptors won this season.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You know, they blew out the Wizards in their one game, but Bradley Beal wasn't playing, and he's a difference maker.
Bradley Beal is kind of good and stuff. You know who's not good? The Toronto Maple Leafs. They've lost eight in a row, but percentage points are going up. 6% chance at Connor McDavid as they continue to fall down the National Hockey League standings. They're in Philly tonight in a must-lose. They're pretty good in these must-loses. They had to lose on Thursday to Arizona, and Jonathan Bernier came through in spades in Philly tonight, Tuesday in Nashville, and Friday in New Jersey. We'll talk about what the hell's going on with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and is this the greatest situation that they've been in the last 10 years as far as being able to rebuild? All that and more coming up next. I'm Ben Ennis. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Jeff Zarum. You guys should get married. You'd be Jeff Zarum. Dave Zarum and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. The top topics. The headiest headlines. Debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. Toronto Maple Leafs are not good. They have one win in 2015. The potential for their worst month ever as they go to Philadelphia tonight, 7 o'clock on CBC Hockey Night in Canada Styles. Eight straight losses, 1 point in that eight-game span, and just one win in their last 14 games. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's insane. This is a team that was... not unlike last year, actually. You know, it was kind of, you know, battling to get into that top three in the division, looking pretty solid. They were the top scoring team in the National Hockey League. They start slumping. Randy Carlyle gets axed. Now, not only are they not scoring, they're continuing to not win. And a guy who you thought was your number one goalie for the foreseeable future, I don't know how good he is. Jonathan Bernier was... I don't know if I want to call him bad. because that doesn't tell the whole story of that Arizona game, because for 40 minutes, he was the reason they were leading that game. But he was also the reason they lost that game. Allows the 120-foot goal, allows the horrible short side goal. They lose 3-1. They now have a 6% chance at Connor McDavid. And Jeff, maybe Bernier is a pretty good place to start, because this is a guy at some point very soon, this team's going to have to make a decision on. And we know number one goalies aren't that easy to come by. You don't normally luck into them, unless you're the Winnipeg Jets, who apparently have figured that out. But, I mean, what do you make of Jonathan Bernier? Because he's had his moments. I mean, before he got hurt, he was the reason why they were so good last year. And he's shown flashes this year when he was getting peppered 45 shots a game. Maybe he needs that, Jeff.
Yeah, it's what happens with him. It's been kind of unexplainable. And he was been so good last year, and he was so good at the start of this year. And in January, his numbers have just plummeted. His save percentage is below 900. I think it's 894 or something for the entire month. And the Arizona game, those goals were just horrible. And it was just the mental lapse on that Toskala-like goal. And
yeah, although that might have just been a fluky thing. It's hard to fault him on. But what kind of irked me and kind of maybe not irked, but got me a little concerned were the post-game comments about how the crowd got on him at that point, which, I mean, you shouldn't be surprised about. And he said that affected him and maybe allowed him to lose focus and allow that the go-ahead goal, which was worse. That's horrible.
That's not a good sign.
That's not good. You're a goalie.
No, goalies have to be the mentally tough ones, and they're like pitchers, and they got to be in the zone, and they got to ignore. If that's getting to you in a city like this, that's scary.
Yeah, it's not good. There's not many good things to talk about surrounding this team. At least, you know, during the Randy Carlyle era, Jeff, they were at least entertaining to watch. You know, they were the highest scoring team in the National Hockey League. They can't score a goal. They've scored more than one goal in a game once over this 8-game span. They've been shut out 3 times. They've scored one goal 3 times. 4 times, and lost in a shootout to the Devils. We were talking about this the other day, and I know they were talking about it on the morning show the other day as well. If there's a Raptor game on at the same time as a Leaf game, like, is there much of a decision to be made there? Even if you're a lifelong Leafs fan, hey, Jeff, I know it's part of your job. You have to watch them on occasion. What was watching that Devils game like?
It was painful. They're dull. They're uninteresting. Their offensive structure is all the fun parts about them are gone. But back to what you said before, I know the on-ice product is terrible right now. I honestly think this is the best thing that could happen to them.
Yeah.
I think winning in the short term just hides their issues, and I think just gives them false hope. And they made the playoffs a couple years ago, and it led to them overpaying for David Clarkson, and they thought they got Dave Boland, and they thought they're right there, but that just contributed to a bigger problem. And I think, honestly, this is the best thing that could happen. So, I hope they should lose every single game this year.
So you mean this kind of opens the window for, like, big sweeping changes?
Yeah, I think this kind of exposes what the group is. This group isn't good enough, and I think they kind of need this to kind of really show this is the problem with them. And I think a high pick would be the best thing that could happen. Everyone says you should build for the draft, and when they're getting good draft position right now. They're closing in on the top six, at least.
Yeah.
But everyone's throwing their arms up in the air like, well, this team's an embarrassment. This is perfect for them, I think.
But they're, speaking of embarrassments, I mean, their draft history is pretty brutal too, right? I mean, I don't know how can you bank on the draft as a solution unless you're getting McDavid and really combusting.
This is a different front office. Brent Shanahan's never really made a first round pick here, and most likely you'll have a new GM next year. So it's kind of unfair to tie the past with this almost entirely new regime that Shanahan's brought in. So that's a fair argument, but I don't think it applies in this situation, especially in a draft with that could be a game-changing player.
And recent history would suggest they're getting a little bit better, at least with their first-round picks. It's the deeper picks where other teams are hitting. Mm-hmm. You know, you got the Red Wings, and, of course, every Swede that they pick turns into superstar. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, their first-rounders are okay. I mean, Morgan Riley's a pretty good player. At least seems like Stuart Percy might be okay, and William Nylander scored the other day. But, yeah, it seems like from everybody that breaks down the top prospects for this summer's NHL draft, this draft is going to be one of the deepest in years, and you don't need the number one pick, even though you get a 6% chance of that. You know something about frozen envelopes in the NBA? Dave, this team needs a frozen envelope situation.
And, you know, they'd be a team that the league would be, you know, it would be maybe in their best interest to hook that up, right?
I don't know if
maybe
that's
not
true.
For McDavid's sake, but, oh, you think they should build another market
with
McDavid?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, the TV numbers, the attendance numbers always going to be there for the Maple Leafs.
True.
Wouldn't you try and prop up another team that wouldn't necessarily have the TV and attendance numbers? I'm not sure about that. You mentioned it, Jeff, that Brendan Shanahan, it's hard to judge anything he's done because, well, he hasn't really done a whole heck of a lot. It doesn't speak a lot to the media, and he hasn't done a whole bunch yet. He's fired a head coach. He's hired a bunch of assistant GMs. Let's talk about the offseason for this guy. I mean, there's going to be a lot of decisions to make. Head coach, because, sorry, Peter Horacek, the writing seems to be on the wall that you are not going to be the head coach of this team going forward as you're off to the worst start for any head coach in Maple Leafs history. You're likely going to have a new GM because I'm with you. I think Dave Nonis is probably on the way out, and he probably should have seen the writing on the wall with the hiring of a bunch of assistant GMs behind him. So now you talk about a season maybe of observing for Brendan Shanahan. This offseason, he's actually going to have to do things, which will be interesting.
Yeah, because this year, I don't think he had any expectation. I think he had a roster he wasn't thrilled with. I think the cap situation he wasn't thrilled with. And I think he had a coach he wasn't thrilled with. And none of the coaches he wanted became available. And this offseason's he's got to start his rebuilding program because this team is not good enough.
And isn't a lot of that going to have to come through trades? Because don't they have some pretty big contracts on the books?
Their cap situation isn't getting any better anytime soon.
So I guess if you're Shanahan or whoever the GM's going to be, what's your strategy here? Are you trying to get rid of guys like JVR, whoever, get young talent in? Really
you're talking
about
a 25-year-old, though, in JVR, 25, 26, Phil Kessel. Yeah, so, I mean, these are not old guys.
And that makes it that much more, the problem that much more difficult for these guys to solve, right? Because it's not like you clearly have to dump these old guys and start young again. Because, like you mentioned, these guys are maybe entering their primes even.
I think, clearly, if you could dump a contract of a Dion Phaneuf, that's something that they are looking to do. I would imagine that is the priority for this team almost. And Jeff, okay, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but I almost feel like if you're doing that, don't you immediately regret this contract that you signed him to about 12 months ago? I mean, they could have easily just not had Dion Phaneuf on this roster, not had that cap hit if they don't sign him, but they felt like he was the best option out there on the free agent market. Now you got a decision to make with Cody Franzen, who's an unrestricted free agent at the end of this season. Am I incorrect in thinking that this team would almost just take whatever they could get for Dion Phaneuf on the open market?
Yeah, I'd go as far as think anyone's crazy. I didn't agree with you.
Yeah.
I don't see any reason why you wouldn't be having a buyer's remorse about this contract.
And that's the thing when you sign guys to those monster contracts, any sport, you know, you really have to make sure you're giving it to the right guy. Because if you don't, that hamstrings you for years, years.
Yeah, this isn't football. You can't just cut guys and have a small payment to make.
I mean, not to bring it back to basketball, but we saw last night with Joe Johnson. I mean, that guy's making $23 million a year. It's stopping the Nets from being able to get better. Same thing with Phaneuf. He's gonna be an impediment for this team.
And that was kind of the problem with Dave Nonis. He kind of lacked vision. He kind of just, any player he would give them, he would just pay them their market value and even overpay some of them. And you can't just do that. That completely hamstrings you. In today's NHL, it's so hard to make trades and so hard to move these big contracts without taking one back. Those deals are really going to limit this team's future.
Well, I mean, we talked about building through the draft and how you'd like to do it. I don't know if there's a way in this NHL to build a team other than through the draft, because you can't make trades for good players, really. I mean, Phil Kessel maybe was the last good hockey trade you could make.
On Sportsnet.ca, they had an interesting story, which was like, you know, here's the top 12 upcoming free agents or whatever it was. And it was a pretty sad list. I mean, because of these long-term contracts, it's also kind of killing free agency in a way, at least as a tool to really, really build your team. So, I mean, what's left outside of the draft?
And you saw with David Clarkson, he was the best player on a bad market, and the Leafs got desperate.
Yeah.
And they gave him a contract that had way too much term, and they're getting nothing out of it. It's hurting the team, in fact, and that's why I keep saying losing is the best thing for these guys right now. They need to stockpile young assets, and I think getting into the top five in this draft class would be unbelievable for them.
Top two might be difficult, and eventually you would think this team will win a game before the end of the season. I just don't know when that's going to happen. But as it stands right now, in pretty good shape, 6% chance of that winning that draft lottery and drafting first overall, and Ottawa, Columbus, New Jersey, Carolina, and Arizona all have games in hand on this Maple Leafs team. 11:13, Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Jeff Simmons. Want to get to a few things before we get to our predictions and maybe breaking down the game for Super Bowl 49. Marty Brodeur retires this week as a St. Louis Blue, as we all knew he would. I don't know. Actually, you know what? Split opinions on this, because on the one hand, you wanted to see Marty Brodeur as a Devil. I don't think there's a single person that is happy watching Marty Brodeur retire as a St. Louis Blue and getting into his seven games. And I know he did get a few more wins to add to his NHL record total, and he got another shutout, but doesn't get to the 700 wins. But on the other hand, it's hard to rip a guy. I mean, he went out the way he wanted to go out.
And also, how many legends, you know, any sport, how many legends, you know, aren't able to really wrap up their career in the way that, you know, we want to, you know, the storybook ending, you know, think of Jordan on the Wizards, whatever. There's so many examples of guys who, you know, Guy Lafleur on the Nordiques. I mean, these guys, you know, it's hard to hang it up when you're given that chance, even if it's not with the team you've been with your whole career, you go for it. And, you know, does it tarnish their legacy? You know, I think we'll look back on Marty Brodeur as the great Devil. We won't really be fixating on, you know, the seven stints or seven games with the Blues.
Yeah, and I've kind of been confused that people have been up in arms that Brodeur didn't take a job with New Jersey. That doesn't really make sense to me. Look, Jordan's first job is with the Wizards.
Mm-hmm.
Gretzky's first job, Phoenix Coyotes. This happens all the time. And do you really want to take a job with New Jersey
right now? Like, I could be wrong in this. Correct me if I am. But, I mean, didn't they kind of – I don't want to say they gave up on him, but they clearly moved on from Brodeur. So, yeah. I mean, that's got to hurt him too.
And, well, they saw the writing on the wall
that
the St. Louis Blues eventually saw as well.
Well, one, the organization's not great right now. Lou Lamoriello's kind of lost his magic in the team.
They have two head coaches or something?
Yeah, they have one of the strangest rosters I've almost ever seen in any sport. It's full of, like, guys you didn't even know played in the NHL anymore. And
coaching by platoon as well. Mm-hmm. Although they were good enough to beat the Leafs in a shootout the other day.
But I mean, I don't think Brodeur's new Blues legacy, I don't think it changes anything in terms of where he stands historically. You know, I still consider him obviously one of the better goalies of all time. I don't know if I'd say he's the best. But
it was kind of curious that he didn't mention the Devils at all, though, in that post-game news conference. How do you not mention Lou Lamoriello or the Devils at all?
I mean, you wonder how long before that. I assume that's going to wear off eventually. It's still kind of fresh in his mind. But, yeah, that's certainly interesting. That is his team, you know, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah, and one of the best of all time, naturally. Mm-hmm. With the number of wins, number of shutouts, NHL records on both fronts. Also this week, pretty good showing for Canadians at the Australian Open. Jeannie Bouchard gets to a quarterfinal and ends up facing Maria Sharapova, who eventually gets to the final before losing to Serena Williams. And Maria was just too good in that match. It just seemed like she was on a different level compared to Jeannie.
And she probably is.
I suppose. But what are we talking about with Jeannie Bouchard? I'm of the opinion that she was good enough to win a Grand Slam, but she was thoroughly outclassed in that match.
Yeah, I mean, she's in a situation in her career where I think she needs to be beating. You know, we should judge her based on, you know, obviously it's great getting to the quarters. She's killing it against inferior competition, as she should. She plays really well against people right at her level. But, you know, against that, you know, Sharapova's number two in the world, and it's a good measuring stick for Bouchard. You know, she's 0-4 right now. They didn't look like they were in the same class last time. And I think, you know, I spoke to her coach after the match, and they won't say that, you know, Jeannie needs to beat Maria Sharapova, you know, in order to kind of get over that hump. But I think she does. You know, you need to step past these really tangible obstacles in order to kind of progress in your career. Right now, I agree, she could win a Grand Slam if she can skirt around those top players. But, you know, for the time being, you know, she needs to really kind of prove that she can win against them.
Well, I think it's a different situation where on the men's side, you've got four players who, you know, at certain points have at least three players have all had a case to be made that they are on pace or are the greatest of all time in Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, and Rafa Nadal. You don't have that on the women's side. It's more wide open, although, I mean, you're talking about Serena. Maybe she has that case. But Maria Sharapova is not an all-time player. I mean, she's got a few Grand Slams in there.
No, she's not, but she's still obviously far more accomplished than Bouchard, and, you know, age is a huge part of that. But I do think when we saw that match, she was a better player. She was a considerably better player, and it wasn't just, like, an anomaly. I think that's kind of where they're at right now. Bouchard will be a great player. She is a very, very good player right now. What is she, number 7 or 8 in the world? So she's obviously a very good player, but there's still that gap, you know, and until that's shortened, she's going to have a rough go against people like Sharapova or Serena.
As far as Milos Raonic is concerned, it's a situation where I don't think many people give him much of a chance against Novak Djokovic. I know I didn't. And he did take him to a first set tiebreak, which is neat and stuff. Did lose in three in straight sets, in three sets. And his wins against those big three are very limited. He's beaten Roger once, I believe, is his only win among Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer. But he's not the only one that has a record that against those top three.
I think
three.
Those names you're bringing up,
Jeff, as your outlook on Milos Raonic changed, I think most people view him as a kind of a cut below Jeannie Bouchard's ultimate ceiling, but that might just be because of the era in men's tennis he plays.
Yeah, it's hard to live up to the all-time great players you're talking about. And his game's getting better, and he's progressing.
I think he's really improving.
Yeah, he's progressing, and he's from my hometown, so I got a rooting interest in him.
Thornhill.
Yeah, Thornhill, him and Andrew Wiggins and me. And, yeah, I don't think he got any break points against Novak Djokovic, and he's still at the second level where he can't really get into the top, but it's hard to blame a guy for that. These are all-time great players. And
what I like about what we saw with Milos in the tournament and even against Djokovic is how we're seeing him adding more elements to his game. You know, he was pretty one-dimensional before with the big serve and maybe a big forehand, but I really like the way he's moving around the court. He seems to be kind of a harder out, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, Djokovic is so good that it's, you know, he's going to make a lot of people look bad. But I think, you know, Milos is really showing strides in areas of his game that he had to get better at.
And he wears short shorts as well, so shout out to the John Stockton-style shorts. Tiger Woods, it was entertaining to follow him on Twitter because he was playing before the coverage started yesterday, the Waste Management Phoenix Open, and started on the back nine and shot a 44, you know, triple, a couple of doubles, ended up with a career-high 82, just the second time in his professional career that he's shot an over 80 round. Happened at the Open a number of years ago and happened yesterday. And this is a guy coming off a couple surgeries, right? He's missed a whole bunch of time. It's a guy who lost a tooth maybe last week or maybe long before that. But it's a guy who also, let's not forget, was PGA Tour Player of the Year just 2 years ago. I mean, he hasn't won a major in a long time, but he's not that far removed from being one of the tour's top players. And Dave, if we're talking about this guy not even being, you know, in the conversation among the tour's top players, I mean, what hope does he have of winning four more majors?
Well, you know, it's interesting with golf, though, because more than any other sport is you have the time to kind of build your legacy. You know what I mean? I mean, especially when you consider how young he started off, you know, he's going to have the luxury of having a lot of chances to do that. You know, I'm kind of with you, though. You know, when you watch him right now, I mean, it doesn't look like he's anywhere near where he was, and it doesn't look like he's going to get back there anytime soon, but he will have the luxury of time.
Yeah, you can play golf forever. I think most people in their 60s understand that.
I was just in Florida. I can vouch for that.
Yeah. also, NBA announcing its All-Star reserves the other day. Jonas Valanciunas, DeMar DeRozan, not All-Stars. Although Jeff Van Gundy said JV should have been an All-Star. What did you make of that comment?
I mean, it's a great endorsement for Valanciunas. I don't think you could have put him in over another center in the East, Nick Vucevic. You know, I think he's more deserving at the center position over Valanciunas. But, you know, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the way Valanciunas plays against the top centers, guys like Joakim Noah, Vucevic, you know, Cousins, the way he plays against those guys, he shows that, you know, he is not too far from that class. He is a guy who might be in that all-star discussion one day. I don't think you could have put him in this year, though.
What do you make of this year's skills competition, All-Star Saturday, they call it, with the dunk contest going back to some old rules? The other events are still in there. We were talking in the break about ways to improve that All-Star Saturday. This one coming February 14th in New York City. I mean, one-on-one would be unbelievable. Yeah. Having the best players in the dunk contest would be unbelievable. And people, I think maybe Bill Simmons was the first guy to come up with offering the winner $10 million, putting it at center court.
Yeah.
I mean, LeBron James, I don't care how much money he has, LeBron James is taking part in a dunk contest in which the winner gets $10 million, right?
And you know, it was interesting, too, watching the NHL All-Star Weekend. You know, they really do have their biggest stars competing in those competitions, and it kind of did illustrate how much, you know, that doesn't happen in the NBA. I mean, I'm okay with it because, you know, if a guy doesn't want to do it, I want to see a guy who's motivated to go in there and really impress people. I like the fact they could help build names and whatnot. But you know, obviously you want to see the big names in there. I think for your one-on-one idea, that would be unbelievable. I mean, who would you take in that?
LeBron would be the consensus number one overall pick, right? But
you know, I think right now the way he's playing, I'd go with Harden. He's just got there's so much to his game, you know. He's just beating guys off the dribble so easily. He takes contact so well. I just the problem with the one-on-one thing is, though, you know, who wants to be the guy to get embarrassed by someone else like that? It's just you out there alone getting schooled if you lose.
Yeah, but you could do it. Okay, first bucket wins. Or if you score, you have to win by two, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you score, the other guy gets a chance to score. And whoever, maybe then it goes to sudden death or something.
Is there home court officiating or is it street ball rules?
It's street ball rules. Yeah, prison rules. You got to call your own fouls.
Yeah.
All right, and
NBA. Every second, guy's calling a foul.
That's the thing. Are they gonna? Is LeBron gonna jump into him and expect a home court call? Or
no? There's no referees. But
you know, I liked when they had Horse. Remember when they had Horse a few years back?
Right.
I mean, the problem was that the players always seemed like half asleep. Maybe they were because they held it like in the morning or at noon.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that's something really interesting. It can show you guys creativity. You know, shot making ability and whatnot. We saw Rondo. I think it was Rondo against Durant when they were both like early in the league, and Rondo was holding his own in a like long, deep 3-point shootout that broke out in the middle of a Horse competition. And that was fun. And, you know, I think they're getting away from kind of just fun at the All-Star weekend. And it's going to be interesting to see if they can get back to that.
Yeah, it's gone stale.
It really has. And it's worrisome because there's so much potential there, you know. I think the 3-point contest might change that, though, this year.
Yeah, I used to love the dunk contest growing up. And when Vince Carter used to do it, he was at the top.
Even like Jason Richardson versus Desmond Mason.
Jason Richardson, I may have my favorite dunk.
Can I guess?
The through the legs reversed windmill.
That's it, yeah.
That was one of the greatest, maybe most underrated dunk in the history of the dunk contest.
Maybe the most underrated moments in professional sport.
Well, that's a little much. Okay. All right, I'll follow you.
I said maybe.
And I know Kobe Bryant's hurt right now, just had shoulder surgery. But who's not watching Kobe Bryant and LeBron James one-on-one, right? I mean, I know they played recently in L.A. a couple of weeks ago with LeBron healthy, and there was one moment, it was surprising, the entire game, there was only one moment where they were guarding each other. And even in a game, a meaningless game, where the Lakers are going to be one of the worst teams in the NBA this season, and the Cavs have turned it around, of course, it's going to be in the playoffs in the Eastern Conference. That moment was so special in that game. How can you recreate that? That's what I'm trying to do.
Well, listen, aside from like pitcher versus batter, I think, you know, no sport lends itself better to like that one-on-one kind of marquee matchup. I mean, even think back in Toronto, think back to Vince Carter versus Allen Iverson, those duels. The league's perfect for that. So, yeah, I mean, the one-on-one competition kind of just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the stars do generally turn out for the 3-point contest.
Yeah.
But you see a lot of times, I know Steph Curry is, you know, one of the better 3-point shooters in all of the NBA because he gets it off so quickly. He
can maybe shoot, the best ever, yeah.
He shoots well. I mean, Kyle Korver is shooting the three at over 50% this year, which is ridiculous. That is a layup for
Curry's
him.
He's just so dramatic with it. His threes just seem like, you know.
But you see a bunch of, you see it quite often, I believe last year where Curry was in the 3-point competition where he struggled with it because he had too much time and he's not used to having, you know, that much open space. And part of what makes him amazing is that he's able to get that shot up with a hand in his face and somebody guarding him.
But yeah, apparently they are going to have the stars in for the 3-point contest, which means Curry, Klay Thompson, Kyle Korver, so you know, Wes Matthews, Dame Lillard. So it should be really good.
So look forward to that middle of February happening, February 13th through 15th. In New York.
And also, real quick, they're doing the World versus USA for the Rising Stars game, which means Andrew Wiggins, Kelly Olynyk on the world team. That should be good, too.
Yeah, Andrew Wiggins has looked good the last
couple
of games as well. I talked to somebody that covers that T-Wolves team last week and said that they couldn't be happier with his development there.
And we got a big magazine story about him coming out.
Look out for that, Sportsnet magazine and sportsnet.ca. When we come back, we will finally break down the game because they will play one apparently in Arizona tomorrow. Super Bowl 49, Patriots, Seahawks, and Jeff Simmons will try to separate himself from his biases as he wears his Marshawn Lynch Cal jersey. I'm Ben Ennis. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live with Dave Zarim and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Dave Zarum and Jeff Simmons. Super Bowl 49 coming your way in more than 24 hours, but just slightly more than 24 hours from Arizona. Patriots and Seahawks. And you look at a line, it looks like Patriots now favored. I think it opened as a pick'em, but Patriots look like they're favored by a point now. And if you were drawing up a dream matchup, I guess this would be it. I mean, you got the two number one seeds in the AFC and the NFC. Great defense against pretty good offense. Although the Patriots defense, I feel, is underrated a little bit this year as well. So let's talk about the actual game and what we think might happen. So Jeff, obviously your knowledge of the Seahawks and knowing who their backup left tackle is, you have a pretty good understanding of what they bring to the table. Maybe give us a sense of where this team ranks compared to the team that was in the Super Bowl just 12 months ago and laid a beatdown on their AFC opponent, the Denver Broncos, and why that will not happen this year or why it will.
Well, I think their roster last year was actually a little better, but I think this team is mentally tougher, and I think I would take this team over last year, just kind of what they've gone through this year, through all the adversity. And this year's kind of been three different seasons for them. They came out, it was kind of like the revenge, the action movie. Like, they came out, they looked unbeatable. They killed Green Bay. They beat Denver. And then the Percy Harvin thing blew up. They had that bad loss in Dallas, and they lost to St. Louis.
Yep.
They lost to Kansas.
Rams had some good wins this year, though.
Yeah, and then they lost to Kansas City, and that's where things kind of changed. They figured out their defense, and they got healthy, and they haven't lost since.
It's kind of like the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah. It's a lot like the Mighty Ducks. Thank you.
Yeah, so
it's a lot like Bambi.
Last year, they just kind of ran through everyone almost.
It's a lot like Boogie Nights, I find.
Yeah, football, Boogie Nights, essentially the same thing.
But they did not look good. They did not look like they had much going on offensively in the NFC Championship game, all right? Fair. At least through...
For 55 minutes.
For
yeah, they were horrible.
55 minutes. And then, you know, Russell Wilson explodes with a couple of touchdowns and one of them in overtime to win the game. But before that, he had four interceptions, okay? And this is not a Packers team that was built on defense. They had defensive deficiencies. Would you rank the Patriots' defense as better than the Packers, right? Like, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think
is it fair to say that Russell Wilson might struggle?
I think they're definitely a better defense, especially because of their cornerbacks. Darrell Revis and Brandon Brown are the old Seahawks. They're one of the best secondaries in the NFL, and Green Bay really held down their receivers. It's not a great group of receivers.
And also, the Packers kind of showed a formula to beat Seattle, which is, you know, contain the quarterback, get at him early, you know, disrupt his flow. And you know Belichick and his defense are zoning in on that heading into this game, and it worked for Green Bay.
And what worries me about Belichick is, throughout his history, his number one, he's done this for years, they always take away your strength on offense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with Seattle, if you take away their running game and make them one-dimensional,
who can they pass to?
They have very efficient receivers, but they don't have game breakers who can break one-on-one coverage. And a kind of a storyline that one of their better young receivers who is really coming on at the end of the year, Paul Richardson, he tore his ACL in the first playoff game. I think not having him could really show up in this game.
And you said it. I mean, Revis and Browner, those are two elite cornerbacks, you know, and I don't think the Seahawks receivers are in the same class as them, you know, as far as how they compare to other wide receivers.
No,
right?
Doug Baldwin's a really good receiver, and he's really quick, and he's... But I don't think he's the kind of guy who beats man coverage. And I think that's what they're going to do. They're going to put Revis on him. And I think Seattle really has to run the ball. And I think it's going to really have to go through Lynch and Wilson to open everything up.
Last year's Super Bowl was the first Super Bowl in a while, I feel like, where the result was known within about 7 minutes of broadcast time. And anybody that paid, you know, their $10 million for a 30-second Super Bowl ad was a little disappointed. I mean, that would be shocking if that happened this year, right, Dave? I mean, if you had to blow it either way, I think with how limited we think the scoring would be, that would be a big surprise.
Yeah, I think we can we all agree we're going to expect like a really close game tomorrow. You know, this Patriots team, it's not the overpowering offense of you know the prior Pats teams that have made the Super Bowl. So yeah, you're talking about two great defenses going at it with two offenses with I don't know if you'd say limited weapons, but certainly you know not a plethora of weapons like we've seen in the past. You know, for New England, I mean, Gronk and Brady, you know, a lot's going to be on their shoulders. You know, but also, you know, I heard that Sherman was a little dinged up and some of the Seahawks cornerbacks were a little dinged up. So you wonder,
his arm, we don't know how serious that injury is.
Yeah, so you wonder how that's going to affect how they're able to contain, you know, that combo, Brady and Gronk. But, yeah, I expect a close game and yeah, probably a low-scoring one too.
Seattle, I don't think – there's a crazy stat. They haven't lost a game by double-digit points since the middle of 2011.
That's crazy.
So that's what I'm saying.
They don't – so even if they lose this game, I can't imagine a blowout.
And, you know, that is one thing that Seattle really has in their favors, that kind of, like, close game experience. When you look at what they did last 2 weeks ago, rather, against the Packers, I think everyone agreed that they looked really exposed for most of that game. But it's a weird thing. I mean, how much weight do you put in that comeback? Is that a freak occurrence, or does that speak bigger volumes about kind of the team's makeup and what they're capable of in those moments? And I don't know the answer, but
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you really saw how mentally tough they've become. The fact that Russell Wilson wasn't phased after a 4-interception game, and
yeah,
I think he had like 12 passing yards at halftime. And but yeah, if the guy lets the onside kick go to Jordy Nelson, our conversation
right,
is very different.
Yeah,
we're talking about how the receivers stink and Russell Wilson's maybe we've overrated him, but you got to give him credit. And the big touch at the end, that was an audible. And if you watch any of those NFL film shows, he said before he went in the field, we're gonna check this play if they come out with a zero blitz, which is when they send everyone to stop Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
To have that after a 4-interception game, that blew my mind a little bit.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, really, really impressive way they won that. But also another question on the flip side is for the Pats whooping the Colts like they did, I mean, is that indicative that this is a team that's, you know, really good at another level? Or, you know, are they pretty equal to the Seahawks right
now? I think the Colts were a weak opponent, frankly. I think
overachievers?
I think they overachieved. You played Andy Dalton. You played, like, a broken-down Peyton Manning. And the Colts, the four times they've played New England, they've got crushed every single time. And the Colts are essentially a one-man team. Andrew Luck just carries they're a very deeply flawed roster. They don't have any running game. They don't really play great defense. They can't stop the run. LeGarrette Blount's just run over them. Seattle's not like that. But if Seattle does have one weakness, it's the defensive tackle. They've lost a bunch of guys there, and they're not deep there. Their starter is Kevin Williams, who's like 34 years old. He was supposed to be a backup this year, and he's played really well since Brandon Mebane, a guy who doesn't get a lot of attention. He's a really good player. He went down for the year. So if New England can run on them and Tom Brady can get the ball out as fast as he can, it's very fair to think New England's going to win this game because Seattle is not an elite pass rushing team. They're better in the secondary. And I think the teams that have beat New England are the teams that get to Brady. And you saw with the Giants and you saw with the Chiefs earlier this year. And that's not Seattle's strength outside of a few guys.
And we've seen the Patriots at times this season. I mean, the first Colts meeting during the regular season, a good example of them being able to diversify the offense and run the ball down your throat at times. I mean, Jonas Gray had the 4 touchdowns, over 200 yards rushing in that game. Seems like it doesn't matter who's doing it, and now that they seemingly have a pretty good running back and LeGarrette Blount, who, you know,
and that's a great story too, right?
Yeah, and who knows if he I mean, all this was intentional, the way he played his way out of Pittsburgh and ended up back with the New England Patriots after their starting running back went down. But, I mean, is that a game plan you could see working, Jeff, where the Patriots go back to the run and take a little pressure off the arm of Tom Brady?
I think that's the way to beat them. And I think that's, if you've looked at how Seattle lost all their games this year, DeMarco Murray did it to them, Jamal Charles did it to them, and they had trouble with Trey Mason in that first St. Louis game. And I think that would be the logical strategy, but trying to predict what Bill Belichick's going to do is next to impossible. Every week he shows a completely different look that you haven't seen before. Did the ineligible thing with the receivers and the offensive linemen. So giving him 2 weeks to prepare, it's pretty silly enough for me to guess what that guy's going to do.
Who's favored going to this game? Is it New England?
Yeah, by a single point.
I think it's New England.
It opened as a pick'em, but it's been bet down to the Patriots -1. What are the odds that somebody comes up with an inflating the ball celebration in the end zone? Like, if Richard Sherman, like, if he comes up with a pick six, that is happening, right?
I hope so.
Right, it's got it. It's an easy one, too. You just have to
kind of poke. Okay.
You pretend like you're putting the tube into the ball, and then you just like you're putting the plunger down with both hands. I mean, that's happening.
Imagine Twitter after that.
Yeah, I feel like Twitter's going to have a meltdown at some point, no matter what happens in this game. You mentioned that Bill Belichick is, I don't know if he's unpredictable, but he's able to seemingly outsmart just about everybody in the NFL. And part of that, Jeff, I find with this Patriots team is second half adjustments. Maybe no team in the NFL is better at coming out in the second half and playing an entirely different style of game, at least understanding how the game has changed first half, second half, than the New England Patriots. But you look at the Seahawks, especially from a gambling perspective, they've been one of the best second half teams in all of the NFL. They always outscore the opponents in the second half. So maybe you got a couple of teams who do that very, very well colliding in this game.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Seattle, that's, I think, their biggest strength. And one of Pete Carroll's number one philosophies, and it sounds stupid at first, but they really believe this. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. And Seattle in this fourth quarter, they're better than anyone. I think during their six-game winning streak, I think they allowed one touchdown. I think they're almost better than New England in terms of second-half play. And during the coaches' press conference, where they're both out there yesterday, they asked Bill Belichick the one thing he would take away from Pete Carroll, and that was what he said. He said, learning how to play through 60 minutes, and it's amazing how good Seattle is coming out of the break.
Yeah.
And it was pretty stunning hearing him say that. It was pretty stunning all week just hearing Belichick rave about Carroll. And you would have figured he would kind of look down on him. He replaced him. He took over a pretty mediocre team from him. But he's been raving about him all week. It's been strange for me to hear.
Well, and Carroll's kind of been forcing that issue with the way the team's played the last couple of years, right? I mean, mm-hmm. He's really established himself as one of the top guys. I'm still shocked that he's the oldest coach in the
yes.
league.
Yes. Yeah. This is like the oldest duo to collide in a Super Bowl in history. Yeah, he definitely does not look like the oldest head coach in the NFL.
But, you know, the fourth quarter stuff you're talking about, I mean, that's what makes this game so fascinating, is because I think we all expect it to be close. Obviously, the oddsmakers expect it to be close. So it's probably going to come down to that fourth quarter, you know. So to have such a clutch team on Seattle side versus a potent one on New England side, I'm really looking forward to what's going to happen.
Or it'll be a complete blowout because we know nothing. Speaking of knowing nothing, time for our predictions.
Okay.
All right, who we got? Jeff, let's go to you first because I think you're going to be the least surprising prediction of us. Of the three of us.
You know what? Going into the week, initially, I was asked to file a prediction for Sportsnet, and initially I planned to take New England, as surprising as that sounds. It hurt me inside, but...
No, you wanted to do it so that you felt good either way.
No, then I just thought the Deflategate, I thought the Deflategate and 2 weeks of Brady and Belichick, I thought it might be a little much for this Seattle team, so a little depleted, just come with some injuries. And as the week's gone on, I've started to lean the other way. I just think Seattle, if they can run the ball, I think that really fits into their strength. And I think Seattle's done such a good job against, like, the top quarterbacks. They killed Peyton Manning. They've done great against
Rodgers. They haven't played a whole bunch of top quarterbacks in the last 5 weeks.
Not this year, but they
so.
Played Breeze twice last year. He did nothing. And I think one thing that kind of swung me is everyone who's in Arizona says it's crazy favored to the Seahawks in terms of fans. I'm wondering, apparently it's like 10-1 Seattle and New England.
12th man effect.
I think it could be like a home game just because of the snow in New England right now. It's probably hard to get out of there right now.
Yeah.
And Seattle's close to Arizona. And apparently the New England, the radio broadcaster was on a Seattle station. He was complaining about it. He thought he was embarrassed that the New England people weren't out there. And he's one of the biggest homers. He's from Boston, obviously. So I'm going to go Seattle. I think it's going to be close. I think they make
Speaking
one.
Speaking of homers.
Yeah, big homer. I did pick Green Bay to win the Super Bowl this year, by the way.
Yeah, not far off.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe a recovered onside kick.
I think what Dave said, yeah. I think it's going to come down to one play, and I think Seattle's just fourth quarter play separates them, but I could be wrong, and I'm even as a Seattle fan, I'm not confident at all. Brady scares the hell out of me.
All right, be confident, Dave.
New England Patriots 23, Seattle Seahawks 17. Final play, Seahawks have the ball with a chance, you know, to win the game on a touchdown. Russell Wilson
Can
launches.
Can you play receiver?
Yeah.
He'd be an amazing receiver.
Yeah.
Wilson launches a ball to the end zone, picked off by Revis. Game over.
I'm taking the Patriots as well in a close game. And the sight of a helmet catch, I'm going to take Richard Sherman to intercept a ball crazily against his face masters.
And then celebrate appropriately.
Yes, by inflating the football. All right. That'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. Get the nachos out. Go buy TV if you haven't done that, because apparently this is like the biggest week as far as electronic sales in North America.
And returns too, right?
And returns immediately on Monday. All right. Thanks for listening. I've got another edition of Sportsnet Today coming up at the top of the clock. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live with Dave Zarim and Jeff Simmons. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.